The living dead and the dying living are all the same, cut from the same cloth. But disposing of dead people is a public service, whereas you're in all sorts of trouble if you kill someone when they're still alive.
Yeah.
We all feel better.
We all feel better in the dark.
And now our featured presentation.
This is my business. They pay me for it.
Yeah.
Hey, how are you doing? This is Derek Ferguson.
And this is Thomas DJ with your bonus edition of that show that you gotta have.
And know something, if you don't have it, well then I'm sorry, you're just simply not him.
If you don't have it, you gotta get it. If you gotta get it, you need to find it. If you need to find it, you gotta look for it.
Yeah. That's the commercial.
Yes.
That's the Bruce Campbell.
Yes.
That was the funniest thing I had seen in such a long time. The first time I saw it, I said, what the hell did he just say?
And that's part of a whole Old Spice, because they're trying to change their image from being the aftershave your dad buys.
It's not your dad's Old Spice.
There's like a print ad, a footlong hot dog, with the thing, what, we can't just put a footlong hot dog here without nasty comments?
Because back then when I was growing up, there was really only two colognes that men wore. Old Spice and High Karate.
Oh, yeah. Everybody remembers the High Karate commercials with a little nerdy guy getting thrown around by his girlfriend?
Yeah. Good times, indeed. Good times, my friend.
But we're not talking about aftershave commercials today.
But it's all right to have a little fun once in a while.
Oh,
how you been doing?
Mesa.
Mesa.
You know, it's Italian. It's like same old, basically.
Oh, okay.
Which is appropriate considering one of the films that are on the docket for this first annual Halloween suggestion
first
episode.
First annual Halloween, what we hope will become a tradition if we don't get run out of town. And if we keep this going long enough, we'll be doing this hopefully every year. Where we'll just make suggestions, these horror movies that you may not have seen and you may have seen or forgotten. Or never even heard of. Usually because around Halloween, you know most people talk about the usual ones like Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
The Nightmare series.
Alien.
Friday the 13th.
Not that there's anything wrong with those movies.
No, those are great movies, but maybe you want something off the beaten track.
Exactly. There's a whole wealth of other movies out there that people may not have heard of. And folks, that's why we're here.
And by the time you hear this is going to be probably the last few days before the deadline to our contest.
Tell about the contest.
We're going to tell you a little bit about the contest. As you know, those of you who've been with us since May when we started this, we don't have a logo yet.
We desperately need one.
Because we want to make money. And how do you make money? You find a logo and you put it on crazy crap for people to buy.
T-shirts, coffee mugs, notebooks.
Panties.
Mouse pad.
Yeah, there you go. Phone. The whole thing.
Yeah,
right.
All
DVD kinds. Cases.
Yeah.
We don't have the talent to put together a logo ourselves. So we decided to throw it to our fan base. You guys are a fan base, right?
They better be.
Because we all know what you do with night.
I know what you do.
We decided to throw it open as a contest. To enter this contest, there are a couple of requirements. You have to join our Yahoo mailing list. And that is at movies.yahoo.com/groups/better-in-the-dark. Sign up there. The reason we ask you to sign up there is because there is a section in Yahoo Groups that allows you to post pictures. Once you sign up and we approve you, put together your logo design and post it in the photograph section. We will take a look at it. Anyone who is a member of the group section can vote, but our decision is what really matters. But we'll take your choices under advisement.
Absolutely. But like Tom said, we'll be making a final decision. But hey, that don't stop you from saying, hey, you know something? I really like this one, or
right.
I really like that one. Don't be afraid to...
It's going to be all the month of October, so this is probably your last chance to get in on this if you have not gotten in on it already. What's the prize?
Oh, the prize. Oh, you guys are going to love this. The prize is, A, you will
Well, first off, we're going to give whoever he or she is full accreditation on the website.
Absolutely.
And if you're a graphic designer, and people are looking at it going like, what a cool logo.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll hire you, and you'll get money.
It never hurts to have a little credit.
Right.
But you also be a guest host on an episode of Better in the Dark with me and Tom, an episode that you yourself...
You get to choose the subject.
What you want to talk about.
On top of that, we are going to, out of our own pockets, make sure that you get the first copy of whatever it is we do with your logo.
Whatever it is we do,
so you'll get the first t-shirt, you'll get the first coffee mug, the first whatever we decide is going to be in our first wave of release. We're going to pay for that, so you have the first one. Nobody else will have that.
If that's not enough to get you to scribbling, I don't know what is.
Guys, if you haven't done this already, get to working, because the deadline is going to be on October 31st, midnight, 2007. So, we were talking about horror films.
So, we're ready to jump into the
movie? We're ready to jump into the movies.
Jump into our movie thing? Okay. What do you want to do? You want to flip a coin to see who goes first?
Let me get a coin out of my pocket.
I was just
joking. Oh, look, it's interactivity, ladies and gentlemen.
I was actually joking. You can't see it, but he's
subtle interactivity.
He's actually standing up and getting a coin out of his... What's that? A nickel?
A nickel.
All right, go ahead.
Call it.
In the air. Heads. Don't touch it. Don't touch it, I said. Heads.
You go first. You get to go first, Eric. Interactivity!
As usual, I win. My first movie is a movie that I really don't think that a lot of people have heard of. You've heard of the first one in the series, probably, which was the Quentin Tarantino-Robert Rodriguez collaboration
From Dusk Till Dawn.
And there was a second one that was made, which I haven't seen.
Texas Blood Money.
But the one that I'm talking about today is a movie from 2000, I believe, From Dusk Till Dawn Part 3, The Hangman's Daughter. I love this because it combines two genres that I love. Mm-hmm. If you've been listening to me long enough, you know how much I love westerns.
Of course.
And it's also a horror movie. Not only is it a horror western, it's a well-done horror western, which makes it even better. Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino, all they did was executive produce this one.
Right.
They turned it over to a gentleman, P.J. Sellers, his name is. He mostly did a lot of TV work. It starts out with an actual historical figure, the writer Ambrose Bierce, who
is famous for disappearing.
If you ever seen The Twilight Zone, fans of The Twilight Zone who saw the episode "An Occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge," which is the one about the Civil War soldier that's going to get hanged, and he escapes and makes it home, and just as he gets home, his neck breaks, the whole thing was... Right, okay, well, Ambrose Bierce wrote that story. He was a famous Civil
He's
War.
He's also famous for, I forget what it was, there was like a dictionary that he wrote.
The Devil's Dictionary.
The Devil's Dictionary with all these really sick and cynical definitions for things.
Right. He was a Civil War correspondent. Mm-hmm. He was a real-life man of action. And in this movie, he's sick of the war and he's very world-weary. And he heads to Mexico to join Pancho Villa. Along the way, he stops at this town. And in this town, the local, I guess you would call him, gangster, Johnny Madrid, he's getting ready to be hanged by Tamora Morrison, who most of you will know from the recent Star Wars movies where he played Jango Fett. And he's hanging this bandit because he's in love with the hangman's daughter, Esmeralda. The bandit escapes, he takes Esmeralda, and they flee through the desert. Pursued, of course, by Tamora Morrison and a whole bunch of soldiers. Meanwhile, Ambrose Bierce gets on this, who's played by Michael Parks, who is wonderful in this movie. I believe he's been in all three of them, by the way.
He has been in all three of them. He's also been in the last two Quentin Tarantino films.
Yeah.
Playing the same character as he played in the first From Dusk Till Dawn.
Right. He was in the Kill Bill movie.
He's the one who discovers the bride. It's the same character in First Dusk Till Dawn that is in Kill Bill and also in Death Proof.
Oh,
which we'll be talking about soon in the Grindhouse episode.
Ambrose Bierce, he gets on a stage with a bunch of other passengers. Eventually, through a series of bizarre circumstances that I wouldn't dream telling you about, everybody meets up at this strange bar that's out in the middle of the desert. Of course, this is the Titty Twister of course, they don't know that it's called something else, and they go in, and who else is the bartender but our old friend Danny Trejo?
Right.
He plays the bartender, and the woman running the place is Sonia Braga. They go in there, they run up with another character, Orlando Jones, of all things, playing a brush salesman.
Who, as we have mentioned in several episodes, we really like as an actor.
Yeah, all these characters converge on here. Once the sun goes down, they're locked in.
Right.
Everybody in the place turns into a vampire, and all these disparate characters who have no reason to like each other and who are trying to kill each other have to band together to, of course, survive the night against these vampires. This one was released straight to video, which right. means that they were able to go a little bit more out with the gore and the violence, gunfights in here. The director is obviously a student of Sam Peckinpah because that's what they're like. They're very Sam Peckinpah-ish. Once they get in there and the vampire slaughter starts, you look at it and you say, okay, this is what a vampire movie should be.
Right.
With a lot of, got a lot of good sex scenes. If you like lesbian vampires, guys, you're going to love the orgy scene. But the best special effect in the movie may be Sonya Braga's breasts. Now, I have no idea how old she was when she made
She's
this
gotta
movie.
She's got to be at least in her 50s at this point.
Yeah, well, this is 2000. She had been around in movies for a while before this.
Yeah, I mean, I remember stuff of hers from the 70s.
Yeah, Kiss the Spider-Woman. Was right. she in that was, one? Yeah. Stuff like
well,
that.
Well, she was the Spider-Woman yeah. in that one. That was in 1982.
And she takes every opportunity in this movie to display her wares. That's the best special effect
oh,
in the
you know,
movie.
I think there's something about Latina women that just make them age
oh,
more slowly.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, look at, we're talking of Salma Hayek. Oh my God, Salma Hayek is what, 40-something at this point?
Uh-huh.
And she still looks like she's barely into her 30s.
I know women who said they never even once thought about being with a woman sexually. Right. They said, but Salma Hayek, yes, they can see turning for her. Right. That's how beautiful she is. This movie, it's a wonderful gore fest. The acting, the production values, the special effects are much better than you would think mm-hmm. for a direct-to-video project. I mean, I was watching it, I said, wow.
Well, this released under the Troublemaker Films banner. It's a Dimension, the release, considered a Troublemaker film.
It was under the Los Hooligans. Robert Rodriguez is Los Hooligans.
Yeah.
That's what it was.
Before it became Troublemaker. It does become Troublemaker Studios a couple of years later.
Yeah.
Because the reason I bring that up is that Rodriguez is notorious for being able to produce very good-looking special effects.
Oh, yeah.
On almost nothing.
This is a very good-looking movie. Since he wrote the story that the screenplay was based on, there is a consistency with what went before. And as a matter of fact, as the story goes on, I'm not going to spoil it for you if you want to get it for Halloween, but it does tie back into the first movie. So it comes like full circle. It's a wonderful movie. I recommend it highly. I can't recommend it highly enough. This Halloween, if you're looking for something to watch that you've never seen before, From Dusk Till Dawn 3, The Hangman's Daughter.
Would you consider this a horror adventure film, Omar? Would you?
Horror adventure western. You watch the first 40 minutes, and that's what I love about this movie, because for like the first 40 minutes where they're setting up the characters, right. it's a straight western.
Much like first film, that first 45 minutes was a straight crime thriller.
Well, exactly. You watch it, and you say, okay, well, where's the vampires? Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Trust me, when they show up, the movie takes on a whole other layer of excitement and danger, and it goes out there. It's almost as good as the first, Dusk Till Dawn. Highly recommend it.
Since you started with a horror adventure film, okay. I might as well start with a horror adventure film of my own that also takes place in an earlier time.
Okay.
You know what's coming, don't you?
Yes, I know.
One of my favorite films of all time.
Okay.
One of the last films made by the Hammer Film Studios in 1975. The only film directed by Brian Clemens, the mastermind behind the Avengers. I'm talking, of course, of Captain Cronus, Vampire Hunter.
You may cheer now.
Man, I love this movie.
Who doesn't?
A lot of people don't even know it exists because this was during the tail end of the Hammer film's lifespan. And it got a very bad release on a double bill with Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell through grindhouses. I think only in the major markets. I don't think it ever went beyond New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago. Mm. Horst Janssen, who was chosen because he is an accomplished fencer, as well as an actor, somebody that Clemens was familiar with from his television work, plays Captain Cronus, a Napoleonic soldier who may be a lot older than he really claims to be. You know there's something very strange, because the first time you see him, he's got a classic French épée on one hand, and a samurai sword on the other.
Both of which he uses with equal proficiency.
Oh, gosh, yes. But this is much like The Hangman's Daughter. This is as much an adventure film as it is a horror film.
Right.
He is called by an old friend who is a doctor for this small town in, we're not quite sure where it is. It's always assumed it was somewhere in Germany.
Well, that was the interesting thing about all of the Hammer horror films, in fact, not just this, is that they took place in kind of like a vaguely mythical European medieval. They never nailed it down exactly when it was.
Every once in a while, you would have something like Plague of the Zombies, which takes place very specifically in a particular time, or another one of my favorite Hammer films, Taste the Blood of Dracula, which takes place very specifically in Victorian England, because it plays off of the whole concept of the fact that this was the end of the really sexually repressed era in England. But this one takes place in this kind of hazy world where we're not sure what the time zone is, because it was actually filmed in the countryside outside of Brian Clemens' home.
I would never have guessed.
We know that he's dressed like a Napoleonic soldier, but there's these other anachronistic elements to him.
Right.
And there are also anachronistic elements to the town. So he's called by a family friend who was the doctor to this village. Mm-hmm. And there's a series of mysterious deaths of young women who end up incredibly aged with blood on their lips. The captain takes a look at this with his assistant slash sidekick slash mentor, Grost.
Dr. Hieronymus Grost. A hunchback.
He explains to the doctor, there are thousands and thousands of vampires. Not all of them drink blood, and there's a vampire loose in this city. He teams up with a gypsy girl, played by...
Be Still Your Beating Heart.
Carolyn Monroe. This is the second of only two films she did for Hammer Films, even though she was under contract to them. This and Dracula AD 1972.
And this is probably the movie outside of The Golden Voyage of Sinbad that most people know her from when you say Carolyn Monroe.
It's also probably, I think, to the best of my knowledge, her only nude scene. It's a great film. There's a lot of swordplay in this film.
Oh,
it's not just running around beating up vampires. In fact, there's this whole subplot with this character that the villain hires to kill Captain Cronus, who is played by Ian Hendry, who was the original partner of Patrick McNee.
In The Avengers.
In The Avengers.
Right.
Who apparently was on very hard times at this point, was... a chronic alcoholic, and Brian Clemens gave him this part as a favor. There's this amazing where he tries to provoke a fight with Cronus.
In the bar.
The bar. He's just ignoring them, and then eventually they're about to go in for the kill. You just hear, like, two... And there's a long shot, and one by one, the three people die, fall.
It's the samurai sword.
Yeah.
He's going to take it out, because as long as they were insulting him, he didn't care. But then they started making fun of Grost, his hunchback. Then that's when he got pissed. He takes the sword. You never even see it come out. That's how fast
he does. There's some wonderfully weird little bits of lore in this film. Like at one point...
Like with the frog.
If a vampire trods over the tomb of a toad... The toad comes back to life.
So Grost puts...
Yeah, Grost did, and Carla, the Carolyn Monroe character, are busy burying these little dead toads in boxes.
Which is part of her purpose for being around it, to have somebody so Grost can explain, and by therefore explain to us what he's doing in all these little fascinating little bits of vampirism.
And there's some great villains in this film. There's this like kind of incestuous brother and sister, the brother of which is played by Shane Bryan, who was the other major, quote-unquote, new Hammer horror star at the time. Mm-hmm. He was the other person who was signed to a multi-picture deal. I think he only did about two or three films.
Captain Cronus himself, he does these weird things that are never explained.
Like,
with the leeches on his back.
Doing the meditation with his face covered.
And the smoking dope.
Yeah. He's a pothead. And I mean, he has this whole cover story about coming home from the Napoleonic Wars and a vampire gone to his mother and sister, but you don't quite believe it.
There's something about the way he says it that you're never quite sure. Is this guy really what he says he is, or is he pulling our
leg? And he's also cold as hell, because if you remember, the doctor gets vampirized. And what does he do? Does he kill this guy right away? No, he says, this is a way that we can find out how to learn to kill these guys.
Exactly.
And so, he puts us through these various experiments and hanging him. And
he uses him as a lab rat. And he does it with no problem, because even Carolyn Monroe character says, that's your friend. Basically, he tells him, listen, mind your business. What I do for a living.
And it's a shame that this film did not do well, because it was always intended to be the next great Hammer series.
Oh, yeah.
Clemens had already prepared outlines for two other films, one of which would feature Cronus coming up against the Lord of the Vampires, Dracula, and the other featuring him encountering Dr. Frankenstein. At this point, Hammer was dying. They did one more film after this one, which was To the Devil a Daughter, and then went out of business. It's a pity. And this is a film that I would love to see remade.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. This is a movie that cries out to be remade with modern special effects.
I do want to debunk a myth that many people say that they had to redub Horace Jansen's voice because his accent was so thick.
That's what I've heard.
According to Brian Clemens, he spoke perfect English. And they decided that it was just better, because it was a Hammer film, to have it be more of a conventional English voice. It's out on DVD with a commentary by Clemens and Carolyn Monroe. It's an exceptional film. It's absolutely lush, and it's probably the last hurrah of Hammer as a great film studio.
It's definitely a movie. I know I've seen it about half a dozen times. They usually run it right around Halloween on stuff like Independent Film Channel or one of the cable channels.
Well, I've said this before. But my favorite time, I got a chance to see it on the big screen at the St. Mark's Theater on a double bill with Near Dark.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
Which is another one of my all-time favorite
horror
films.
Yeah.
That's that one.
Okay, then. So the ball comes back to me?
Yes, it does.
All right.
Or maybe we should just say more like the jack-o'-lantern comes back to you.
And my second one is also another movie, much like The Hangman's Daughter, and much like Captain Cronus, is a hybrid of two genres that you wouldn't think would mesh together well, but when they do, it turns out to be something that's totally off the hook. It's 1979's Phantasm, written and directed by Don Coscarelli.
Don Coscarelli is another guy maybe we might want to consider doing an entire retrospective on, because he's an interesting... He hasn't done a hell of a lot, but he's done some weird and interesting little stuff.
Mostly people know him from the Phantasm series, which is up to the fourth one. He'll be doing a fifth one next year.
Along with the long-awaited sequel to Bubba Hotep.
Bubba Hotep, right. Which, and he also did The Beastmaster. That's what most people know him for.
Because there was that period of time where TBS was playing The Beastmaster every hour on the hour.
Oh, my God. It was known as the Beastmaster station. That was when TBS first got started up, and I don't care what time of day you turned it on, Beastmaster was on.
When I was in college, I was part of a comedy troupe called the Ground Zero Club, and we were going to do a public access TV show. And one of the gags that we had come up with was we were going to do a mock telethon. And one of the gags in this mock telethon was we were going to show people what was playing on other channels, so you know you have to stick with us. We had made up a big dry erase board with Mark Singer's picture on it from Beastmaster, and we were just going to draw different things. So it'd be like, a Telemundo, El Beastmastero! On the Weather Channel, the weather in Beastmaster Land!
Yeah, because it got to be ridiculous. It's like, well, does TBS... Did they buy anything else except Beastmaster? And don't turn it on Saturday and Sunday. Forget, you definitely wasn't going to see anything else except for Beastmaster. But Phantasm is a movie, and this is a movie, again, a lot of people have forgotten it, but when I mention it to them, they say, oh yeah, that's the one with the flying ball, right?
Right.
Like the tall guy. And everybody says, well, whatever happened to that movie?
That anyway? And the yellow bile-spewing midgets.
I firmly believe George Lucas got the idea for the Jawas from, because if you look at Phantasm, that's exactly what they look like in this one.
You know, by the way, it just came out on DVD. Anchor Bay just released a special edition DVD.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go get it because I have the first three on VHS and I don't have it, but I want to get it because it's one of my favorite movies. It's a movie I watch every Halloween. The story is this. There's these two brothers, Michael and Jody, that live in this small Southern California town that's never given a name. One of their friends died, supposedly by suicide, but actually he was killed by this big-breasted bimbo while he was having sex with
him. I forgot about the succubus-slash-vampire hooker thing.
They go to the funeral. The younger brother, Michael, who's an inquisitive sort and always follows his brother everywhere because their parents have recently died and he's got abandonment issues. He goes to the graveyard, and after the funeral is over, he sees this 7-foot-tall guy pick up the casket by himself.
Angus Grimm. You know what he was prior to this?
What?
He was, and he still is, a well-respected jazz critic. You pick up a random any jazz album made in the 70s or 80s, and chances are he will have written the liner note.
Matter of fact, he won a Grammy, for that. Right, I remember reading that. He's like a Renaissance man because he's also an accomplished chef, I understand, too. Michael sees this tall man pick up the casket by himself, which had to weigh at least about 500 pounds, because as we saw earlier, there were six guys who they were struggling to lift it. So he gets the idea that there's something funny happening at this Morningside Cemetery and Mortuary. So he starts poking around, and he finds that there are these little midgets, these little Jawas running around that nobody else sees except for him. He has an encounter one night when he goes there to try to find concrete evidence to bring his brother Jody to try to prove to him that there's something's going on. And that's when he first runs into the flying sphere.
Right.
That sticks out these forked prongs and attaches itself to your head. And then a drill comes out.
Yes.
And it drills into your skull and pumps out your brains.
Yes.
Oh, my God. So now, this is when it starts taking a turn into the science fiction arena.
Right.
Because Up until now, it's been a conventional horror movie. But then we find out that the Tall Man is actually some sort of alien from another world, and he's taking the dead from the mortuary, bringing them back down to life, scrunching them down into these Jawas,
right,
and sending them through a Stargate, basically, to a heavy gravity world for slave labor. If that doesn't make you want to see the movie, I don't know what will.
And it gets weirder with the other two films, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. There's a character he's like the goofy sidekick, Reggie, the ice cream man,
right,
who becomes the hero in the later mm-hmm. movie and becomes the ass-kicking as ice cream man you ever right. saw.
It's like, but maybe he should team up with Ash.
Yeah, the characters have a lot in common. The special effects is about what you would expect for that time, but they are effective for what it
is.
Isn't
there also a living severed finger that's like running around this
one? There's a part where Michael cuts off the Tall Man's finger, takes it home in a box to mm-hmm. show his brother, and he opens it up, and it's mutated into this hideous giant fly that flies around the room. And that's when Jody and Reggie are convinced that, okay, Michael's not crazy. There
right.
is something happening at this mortuary. And that's when they really seriously start to investigate. But this movie, it's a lot of fun. It's very enjoyable. Yeah, I know the production values aren't what people would consider to be
state of art. Well, this was done on a shoestring, so of course it's going to look a little...
But I mean, it's terribly inventive. You watch it, and you know how in most horror movies there are things that don't make sense?
Right.
When you get to the end of this movie, you look at it and say, oh, well, it was all a dream. That's why this happened and that happened. Then it has another little thing that, well, was it really a dream?
Mm-hmm.
That leaves you scratching your head. It's very effective is that it plays in that whole thing. Is it a dream or is it not? Because there are some sequences in the movie that are very surrealistic and dreamlike. Like when they have like Michael running from the Tall Man. And we have all had these dreams where we're running from somebody and no matter how hard we run, it's like we can't get away from them. And there's some of that in the way that Coscarelli films the chase scenes between them.
Mm-hmm.
It breezes by. It's like 90 minutes, which is kind of a relief in this age of these overbloated three-hour epics that come out every other week, it seems like. Whereas back then, that was a rarity.
Right.
So it's nice to just have a nice little movie you can just watch in 90 minutes and get it over with. Phantasm, if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend that you pick it up this Halloween. As Tom said, it's out on DVD, so
right.
it should look
good. Just came out this year.
There are three.
Phantasm 2, Phantasm 3, and Phantasm 4, Oblivion.
Oblivion. Phantasm 5 is scheduled. It's in pre-production now for next year.
Coscarelli is going to doing that, and he's also doing the sequel to Bubba Hotep, which is another. Bubba Hotep is a wild, wild film.
We can do a whole episode about Bubba
Hotep. I think we should do a Coscarelli overview.
We can do one about Bubba Hotep right by
itself.
Oh,
gosh,
that's a movie that's so off the chain, it's not even funny.
And now they're doing, I think it's called Bubba Dracula.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You did another hybrid.
Yeah.
I think we'll do another hybrid here. I'm talking, of course, about another person who I think we've already decided we are doing a retrospective on his work in a later date. Mr. David Toohey's Pitch Black.
Yeah.
This was the film that launched Vin Diesel's career about 2 years before Vin Diesel sank it.
Between that and Boiler Room, those are the two movies that...
And then he did XXX, and then things went downhill for him.
I don't understand why he did that, because XXX was created for him as a franchise. Mm-hmm. Did you ever see the sequel?
State of the Nation with Ice Cube.
In the sequel, they make it pretty clean. They said firmly that, oh yeah, well, he got killed.
Well, apparently he's coming back for XXX3, because I guess he's learned his lesson.
I thought that the plan was that every XXX was going to have a different guy. It was going to take over the XXX.
1999, David Toohey, who did a couple of other really interesting science fiction films, does this film. It is about a spaceship that crash lands en route in the middle of a year-long expedition with 40 commercial passengers.
Right.
There's a meteor shower. Kills the captain. They crash land on this planet. The first thing they notice when they come out is that there's three suns on this planet.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the cool things about this movie is Toohey puts a lot of thought into the ecology of this planet, and there's a wonderful sense of lighting design. They first come out, it's very orange, very oversaturated.
Yeah, yeah.
Then when the second sun comes out, the color register changes a bit. At first, you think it's going to be a slasher film because one of the people being transported is Richard Riddick. We don't know much about him. We know that he is a stone-cold killer, according to the supposed cop.
That's transporting him,
played by Cole Hauser, who's now in Gayville.
Who's transporting him to, we hope, prison, where
to,
he won't get
to
out.
The slam, slang for prison in this world.
Uh-huh.
He escapes pretty quickly. Hal's just like going, this guy's, he's killed lots of people. In the first half an hour, he behaves very creepily. There's one moment where they're having this conversation against this big canopy that was once apparently like the bones of a dead animal. And Riddick is on the other side, and Radha Michel, who's great in this film, who plays Fry, who is the officer in charge now that the captain is dead.
Mm-hmm.
And he just reaches Ben and just cuts off a little bit of her hair while she's not paying attention and smells it. You know, like, there's something. It's not going to end right for her.
There's something wrong with this guy.
Yeah. Then we find out there's something much, much worse on this planet.
They got a lot more things to worry about than Riddick.
Yeah, they come across an abandoned mining colony. Everybody has apparently abandoned this place, leaving clothes on the hooks and family photos and toys everywhere. And then the lights go out.
Literally.
And out come what I like to refer to as the scary-ass anchor-headed monsters.
Literally, because don't
yeah. Because there's this big, kind of like Saturn-looking planet.
Eclipse,
and
okay.
Because of the way the thing orbits, there's a period of a couple of days where the Saturn-looking planet is directly in front of the three suns.
Right. So it's total and complete
total and
darkness.
Absolute darkness. And that's when the crazy-ass monsters... And these are crazy-ass-looking monsters. The first time we see them, we're not even sure what we're looking at, because one of the characters ends up being eaten by these creatures before the sunset.
Yeah.
And Radha Michel goes to investigate in these caverns. And the first time we see the monsters, we see her in the foreground, and the background, the walls shift a little
bit.
And you're like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah, what did I just see?
Riddick, because he spent most of his life in a slam, which is supposedly this way underground prison, has had a special surgery done to his eyes so he can see in the dark. He's the only person that they can put their trust into.
To lead them to some place of safety where
yeah.
they hopefully they can there's, barricade themselves against the
Well, the idea is there's this skiff. They want to get
right.
the skiff going,
right.
go up to the shipping lanes and get picked up.
Right.
There's a lot of little twists and turns in the film. And one of the things, though, I really like is that they never give Riddick that redeeming moment.
They don't compromise the character.
He is always a miserable, evil son of a bitch. He has a sense of honor. There's a point where one of the characters proposes killing another character
right.
as bait, and Riddick kills him.
Right, kills the guy who suggests
the guy
it, yeah.
who suggests it.
He said, oh, well, if it's such a good idea, then let's
right.
kill you.
And when he comes back, this person who was unbeknownst to this person was on the chopping block, he goes, don't you dare cry for him. He has this weird, twisted sense of honor, but he is definitely has bigger danger as these monsters. And these are, like, really incredibly weird-looking.
I've seen the movie about, like, two or three times, and I'm still not sure how to describe it. They got that crazy head that looks like
anchor,
a cross
yeah,
between
yes.
an anchor and a
yeah.
boomerang. Man, I don't know what the hell they are.
Well, so apparently, once again, this is a testament to Tui, who basically went to monster designer Patrick Tapalopoulos, who is famous for designing a lot of really great, memorable movie monsters the last 20 years.
Okay.
And said, this is the circumstances of the planet. Design me what this creature would look like.
Right. They just didn't throw together
yeah.
some generic alien,
mm-hmm.
which is what I love and I appreciate about this movie, because after Alien hit big, every
right.
other movie monster like that was basically a variation, like in the movie.
Species.
Basically, everything we had was a biomechanical looking thing.
Not these things.
No. I mean, they're fast, they're scary, they fly.
Yeah.
Because at one point, they just snatch somebody up.
Well, the actress who, she was in Farscape.
That was
we like, see her get torn apart.
That was the second most surprising death I had seen in recent movies, because
yeah.
I had seen the one with Samuel Jackson where the shark gets
yes.
up. Remember that? And it's like, you go, what the heck?
Because he sets this character up to be a major character in the film.
Right.
And she gets literally torn apart in front of everybody's eyes in the most horrible possible way.
Yeah. I mean, the first time I saw it, my jaw drops out. Huh?
Yeah.
It got her? You know why that's so good? Because now you're saying this. Well, shit, nobody saved
yeah,
it.
Exactly.
You know?
And in fact, the person who you've led to believe is the main character ends up getting killed.
Yeah. Not to give anything away.
Yeah.
You have the cop, you think that the cop is going to be heroic. He turns out
yeah.
to be a total asshole.
Total scumbag. Yeah. Well, that's the other great thing. Nobody in this film is pure.
Yeah.
Fry, in the first 10 minutes of the film, she almost kills everybody. consciously kills everybody because, and I quote directly, "I'm not going to fucking die for these
people." Right, she almost jettisons when they're going down.
This is a film that I think has been very badly served by its sequel. This film did very, very well in the box office, enough to garner a sequel, which became The Chronicles of Riddick.
Two sequels. Wasn't there an animated
one? There was an animated one done by Peter Chung, who also did Aeon Flux and the highly underrated Phantom 2020.
Patricia will never let me forgive if you don't mention David Keith.
The Holy Man.
The relationship between him and
that's
and
the thing. The one really, you can say, really true and good guy in this film is played by Keith David. He's a holy man. He's leading a pilgrimage to Mecca. There's this wonderful scene where he goes to Vin Diesel towards the end of the film and he goes, "I would like to pray with you."
Right.
"I have prayed with the others and I want to pray." He's like blowing him off and he goes, "You may not believe in God.
Right.
But he believes in you.
Yeah.
At which Vin Diesel says, "No, you don't understand. You don't get born and you're found with your umbilical cord wrapped around your neck at the back of a liquor store." Then he goes through this whole recitation, this horrible recitation of what his life is, and he says, "Oh, I definitely believe in your God. I just hate his guts." But this man does not give up.
But you really get the sense that they forged a real relationship, and it's the second movie as well.
Right.
That if there's any character that he has respect for, it's probably this guy.
Right. It's that thing that I think is one of the biggest mistakes in that second film, is that they kill the Keith David character off very early in the movie.
Incidentally, you had to mention, because my wife, she's got all of the audiobooks, because he did the voice for the Alex Cross series. My wife is in love with his voice. Did you ever hear the story that he tell about, because there's another actor, a white actor, that's David Keith.
Yes.
You ever heard the story that he tells?
In fact,
he got a lot of jobs, because and he's lost jobs, because casting directors would get their names mixed up, and he would go and they said, "Well, you're not the white guy."
And the thing about the sequel, because the sequel was a definite bald-faced attempt to create a franchise. Is that this film does not need a sequel. It is self-contained in and of itself.
Yeah, if we had never had a sequel, it would have been all right. We got the point of it. We got the point of this character. We didn't have to see it. But
they had to introduce this whole mythology in the second film, of him being the last of the Furians.
I hate it.
There's the character in the film who is not who she seems to be in the movie, who is transformed into basically a bimbo in the second film.
And isn't just me, because I've said this to people before, and they said, "It's like that because it's called The Chronicles of Riddick." The two separate movies has got nothing to do with each other. I mean, two separate stories.
I understand Chewie and Vin Diesel did not. Well, I mean, it was obvious that they were pushing for this to be a franchise. But it was obvious to me that Chewie was like probably saying, "I don't want to do, oh, they land on another planet and they're a different kind of monsters." On the other hand,
because they've got the prison planet plot, and then they got the one with the people that are conquering
the death worshippers.
Whatever the heck they
call themselves.
But then in the middle of, he goes to the planet with the death worshippers and they take that over.
Yeah.
And then in the middle of that, he leaves and goes to the prison planet.
Yeah.
And he has a whole thing on it.
A mess.
That's got nothing to do with what. And then he goes back to the first.
And by the way, this is the film that he turned down XXX State of the Union for. He turned that down, Fast and the Furious, and just put all his money in Chronicles of Riddick, which died at the box office.
I like it in a lot of ways because it's a gorgeous film to look at.
That's one thing. I've mentioned it before. The design work, the cinematography on this film is so amazing.
It's one of the few, and I don't often say that, but it's a movie that I could just look at. Mm-hmm. And it does have good action sequences, good fight scenes. Vin Diesel is a good performer.
And
I like Vin Diesel.
Look at him in this film, and you wonder what happened to him, because he's a legitimate presence.
Right.
He is threatening when he needs to be threatening. He has a charisma that just comes off the screen.
Yeah. He's a legitimate movie star. But he seems hell-bent on self-destructing his own career. What was he doing in that thing, the pacifier? I will never know.
Maybe in a couple of months' time, we'll be asking what Dwayne The Rock Johnson was doing in Game Plan.
Yeah. Don't even get me started on that. Another one who, instead of going and doing the rundown too, like he should be doing. Is it back to me now?
I guess it's back to you.
Okay, the third one that I got, I'm going to go old school.
Woohoo!
1959's House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price. The original one. There was a sequel, which you like.
Well, it was a remake.
A remake,
and we will be mentioning that shortly.
We'll be mentioning that shortly. When people always ask, and they ask me all the time, what's your favorite horror movie? And they're always surprised when I say this one. They don't understand. I grew up watching this. You, like me, remember when it used to be Channel 9. They showed this thing religiously.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up watching this movie every year on Halloween on Channel 9.
Well, I think it was Channel 5 for a long time back when they had, I forget the name of the, I think it was Seymour was the name of the host. Because we were growing up at the very tail end of the horror host.
The horror host thing. Zachary.
It's a lost art. It really is. But I'm getting
Except
ahead of myself.
Except for Elvira. Doesn't Elvira
say Elvira? Well, no, Elvira hasn't done it for a long time. There's also regional ones like Dr. Morgus, who, to the best of my knowledge, is still operating out of Louisiana.
Really? Cool. In this one, Vincent Price plays an eccentric millionaire who buys a house. A house in which seven people have
which
been brutal.
Is the Griffith Observatory.
Yeah, in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Seven people have been brutally murdered there. In the case of one of them, his head was never even found.
That was the brother of Elijah Cook.
Elijah Cook, who plays the caretaker, who, as the movie goes on, gets progressively drunker and drunker because he's freaked out about what goes on.
Right.
And what goes on, you may ask, is very simple. Vincent Price has brought five people who don't know each other, don't know him, have no connection. There's only one thing they all have in common. They need money badly.
Right.
If they will stay the night, and if they will survive the night, he will give them each $10,000. Of course, this means they have to be locked inside with no way to get out. He locks them in, and he gives everybody loaded guns, 45 automatics, just in case.
Little coffins,
just in case. And then the hilarity ensues, so to speak, as all kinds of creepy things happen.
You got that weird blind caretaker woman who seems to be floating around everywhere.
That is probably the most nerve-jolting scene in the whole movie. The scene you mentioned is where Richard Long, who, for those of us who grew up in the 70s, finally remember from Nanny and the Professor, he's one of the guys who needs the money. He plays, this is a name that could only be used in 50s movies, folks, Lance Schroeder.
Yes.
Ace Test Pilot. He's looking for a secret hatch or something, a doorway, and he's tapping on the wall. Now, in the other room is his girlfriend. And she turns around, and when she turns around, it's the old blind caretaker woman standing there with her hands
and claws just kind of.
And then she floats out of the room. And the girlfriend runs out, and she's gone. Vincent Price's wife, who he hates to death, they hate each other bitterly. And she tells she's been cheating on him, but she's not going to divorce him because she wants his money.
Right. In fact, she says, what would you say to $1 million right now to disappear?
Yeah, tax free.
And she goes, no, I'd rather stay around and have it all.
And have it all, right.
And she's got this totally evil little smile.
Oh, yeah. And she spends the whole thing walking around in nightgowns. The woman doesn't have a stitch of regular clothing through the
now,
whole thing.
If they'd had Famke Johnson in the remake do that, I'd be very happy.
And there's a part where she's found hanged, and nobody knows if she did it herself or she's murdered. And then Lance's girlfriend is standing outside of a window, and a rope comes by itself, bars in the window, and wraps itself around her legs, and when she turns around, Vincent Price's wife is floating outside the window, hanging from the thing, and she, of course, goes berserk. Mm-hmm. The head keeps popping up in all these places. Elijah Cook gets progressively crazier and crazier. Blood drips from the ceiling.
Right.
There's floating skeleton. There's a vat of acid.
Which is, of course, what everybody remembers about this film, which is Emergo.
That was the gimmick that William Castle used in the theaters, that actual flying skeleton came down at that critical junction. This movie is so much fun. I don't care what anybody says. It's fun for me. I think it'll be fun for you if you approach it in the right spirit.
I got the rare chance, once again, at the St. Mark's Playhouse of seeing this with Emergo on the big screen on a double bill with the Tingler, and yes, they had
Vibrating
Percepto.
Oh, man. See, I would kill to see House on Haunted Hill on the big screen.
Oh, yeah.
I would love this. When I finally get a big screen, an 80-inch TV with the sensor around everything like that. Believe it or not, this is going to be the first movie I'm going to buy on DVD and watch
And
that.
They released, about 2 years ago, a split DVD. One side is this version.
Right.
And the other side is the 2001 remake by William Malone, which was the first of the Dark Castle projects.
It was a whole bunch of remakes that they did of the William Castle
movie. This was
movies.
The only one that was worth a damn.
Because they did 13 Ghosts.
They did 13 Ghosts, which
with Tony Shalhoub.
They did Ghost Shit. Ghost Shit. Maybe I was
right. Maybe you were right.
Which sucked even more. They did Gothica, which is the film that notoriously you said you fell asleep on four times.
I swear to God, I could never finish watching this movie. And I said, I'm going to watch it. My wife said, just delete the damn thing.
They did House of Wax, which actually is pretty good.
Right, you saw that one, yeah. And I want to see that because you said it actually turned out to be a lot better than you thought.
I just wanted to briefly mention the remake. The remake's its own entity. Even though there are some of the same elements, there is a character called Stephen Price, played by Jeffrey Rush.
Right.
Who's getting in touch with his inner Vincent Price.
He's made up to look like him in a lot of scenes. He sounds just like him. Mm-hmm. He holds his body the same way. It's a wonderful homage.
There is I don't think he's as successful as Elijah Cook is. There is a Elijah Cook analog in Chris Kattan.
I hate that guy.
The problem with the remake, though, is it's four-fifths of a great movie. Unlike this one, well, we don't want to give away the big twist.
No, we don't.
The other one, they don't have that big twist.
Yeah.
If you'll understand what I mean when you see both of them.
Right. I like it. I think you like it a lot better than I do. I did like it because in this one, it's an insane asylum area instead of a regular house.
Mm-hmm.
And they have that creepy basement down there with all that wild machinery and everything.
And those weird preserved bodies and stuff.
The original.
Although, personally, my favorite scare moment, there's this place called the Saturation Chamber.
Okay.
The doctor, who is played by Jeffrey Combs,
right,
who we'll be talking about in an episode that's coming up on the Reanimator series, had this theory that the best way to cure an insane person is to shock him back into sanity.
It's to make him even crazier.
Yeah. At one point, they luck Stephen Price in the Saturation Chamber and turn it on.
Yeah.
And he gets this vision of the doctor, played by Jeffrey Combs, and they do this Van Gogh-esque thing with just very, very weird.
And they also have the scene where I believe that he remembers when the patients took over and slaughtered the whole staff in the hospital.
Right.
Oh, man, yeah.
It is a great cast. It's like Jeffrey Rush, Famke Johnson.
Tay Diggs.
Ollie Larder, who still isn't closing her mouth.
I like everybody except Chris Kattan.
Yeah, and Peter Gallagher. No, but you can get this on the split disc for $10, so it's a good buy.
If you're looking for something for Halloween, instead of...
Because both of these films, I know you like the remake more than you do, but you'll agree with me that
both
films
are
valid.
I mean, listen, I don't knock it. I like it, but if I have a choice between to watch only one of them on Halloween, I go for the original. Mm-hmm.
We're down to the last one.
We're down to the last one, and I know this is a big favorite of yours, and I know this is a big favorite probably of a lot of people, because anytime this movie is mentioned...
1993.
People orgasm.
Cemetery Man. Which I actually forced you to watch.
You didn't force me to watch it.
Okay, you watched it voluntarily.
Oh, yeah. I watched another one that I think you like a lot more than I liked it, but you like
it
a lot.
I'll be the first to admit that it is a very much an acquired taste. It is the fourth film directed by Mario Bava protege Mikhail Suave, and for the longest time it was the last film.
And if we have
did.
To tell you who Mario Bava was, then you shouldn't be listening
to this
program.
Stop listening.
Stop listening to
us. We're rescinding your listening rights.
Yeah.
It is an adaptation of an Italian comic book called Della Morte Della More, which was actually the title in Europe. And it is about Francisco Della Morte, the caretaker of the Buffalora Cemetery, which is a little town in Italy, where for some reason when you bury somebody in that cemetery, 7 days later, they rise up from the grave looking to eat you. He lives this very solitary life. His only real person he can talk to is this bizarre, we're not even sure he's human, called Nagi, played by the French mime, Francois Hadji Lazzaro. And then there's this great line where they said, when he was born, when they put under distinguishing physical characteristics, that he wrote, everyone. You know? He's a great character because he's this like overweight man-child. His dialogue consists of one word. Nah! Yeah. Over and over again. And the funny thing is, Rupert Everett understands everything he says perfectly.
Yeah, perfectly.
They're having total conversations, the two of them.
It's like the best running gag that's in the thing, because it's like, is he psychic?
An argument can be made that a lot of this film takes place in Rupert Everett's head, because he's constantly going to the mayor's office to report that the dead are rising. And nobody believes him.
And it's like everybody takes it very calmly. This is no big deal.
Now, he meets a woman played by Anna Falchi. Actually, he meets three women. They're not named in the movie, so I like to refer to them as the widow, the secretary, and the student.
And they're all played by the same woman.
They're all played by this feline-looking Italian supermodel.
Which lends it even more...
to a dreamlike quality.
Right, to the validity of your theory that mm-hmm. this is taking place in his mind. He's had like some kind of psychotic break or something.
And
like
he's that. Impotent. Yeah. And in fact, there's a murder that occurs where there's evidence that the body had been raped, and they're like, oh, we know it wasn't you, Francisco, because you're impotent. The widow, which is the first one of the three women he meets, is a little weird. She's putting flowers in the grave of her husband, who is much older than her. And I love the fact they keep changing the photo on the gravestone.
Right.
So that the husband seems to be reacting to everything
to
that's going on.
Everything that's happening.
This also features the best, weirdest pickup line in the history of cinema. Because he's trying desperately to get this girl to agree to go out with him. And she's totally passing him off until he says, this cemetery isn't very large, but it does have a lovely ossuary. And she stops dead in her tracks, and this light comes in her eyes. She goes, an ossuary. And the next thing you know...
Now, this is what I'm talking about. There were things like that, and the thing with the picture changing. I didn't know whether I should be laughing or not if I just treat this as a comedy. Mm-hmm. And years ago, I had a very embarrassing moment when I went with some friends to see the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I thought it was a comedy. I was laughing. They were very offended.
There are a couple of moments in the film where even I have to admit... they're kind of missteps.
And I felt this way in Cemetery Man. I'm saying,
oh, I love that.
Should I be laughing at this? Because am I supposed to be taking this seriously? Mm-hmm. It's just that type of movie.
So he comes on to her in the ossuary, but she panics and ends up dying. Then she comes back to life, and he shoots her. Because, of course, the only way to kill the dead once they come back is to shoot him in the head.
Well, everybody knows that.
But then she comes back again. And he realizes, oh shit, I killed her when she was still alive. The thing is, he starts hallucinating, he gets visitations from the Angel of Death.
Yeah.
Who says, look, stop killing my people. If you really want to kill people, why don't you kill the living? The scary thing is, guess what he does? Nobody's well in this film.
What was the thing when he drive out of the town?
It's indicative of this film to say that the healthiest relationship in the film is between Nagi and the severed head of the mayor's daughter.
That should give you some idea, folks, of how well twisted this movie.
When we get to like the last half, he's actively killing people out in the open.
Yeah.
And nobody believes him.
Nobody even seems to care, really.
Well, there's that one scene where he's managed to kill a bunch of people in a hospital. He's going down.
He's going down the stairs.
Going down the stairs, and he meets the police inspector. He's, oh, caretaker, you've got to beware. There's this maniac loose in the sixth floor, and he's killing people. And he's like going, I did it, damn it! and he's like, oh, see, you got a gun. Good, then you can defend yourself.
He's got the gun. He's telling him, and he says, it's like, he just totally ignores what he says.
You can defend yourself. Good.
Drive out on that road, and they get out.
And then there's that weird moment where it seems like Nagi and De La Morte change personalities.
Yeah.
A lot of this film is firmly carried on the shoulders of two people, which is Rupert Everett.
Who is great.
Who was made to play this.
It's got to be rough playing a role like that and do it where you can convey so many different things at the same time, which is what I think he does. At the same time, he conveys that he's totally in charge, and yet he doesn't know what the hell is happening.
He's got that weird fixation with the phone book where he's reading through the papers and cutting out the cemetery notices and crossing people out of the phone book. And I remember at one time Nagi is burning the old books and he's going, what are you doing? Those are classics!
See what I mean? Now when you see something, you're supposed to take this serious? But I think you're right that it's an acquired taste because I want to see it again. And I think that as you watch it more and more and you get a little bit more into the rhythm of what's going on, then you develop a deeper appreciation for it. Because I tell you, the first time I saw it, I honestly did not know what to make of this movie.
Very, very weird film. And it was this film that made me convinced that if they ever got so desperate in the X-Men series that they were going to do a version of one of my favorite mutants, Pete Wisdom,
Rupert Everett is the man
to play that character.
I could definitely see him playing the part.
Just be prepared because it is a very odd film and it might be a little bit of a shock to the system. There's some violence in it, but it's not a very violent film.
It's definitely not what you would expect from this type of movie.
And then you have like also the other comedy sequence. At one point, a motorcycle gang collides with a busload of nuns and Boy Scouts. And so, of course, they come back 7 days later, but they're coming back earlier. Mm-hmm. The cycle is closing the gap. He's, like, trying to get Nagi to come up and bring the gun, but Nagi's too busy watching War Blob, is the name of the TV show. And he's, like, got the headphones on, and he's eating spaghetti.
And
he's totally oblivious. And meanwhile, there's Everett going, Nagi! And I love the fact that, like, one of the Boy Scout zombies is trying to light a fire. He's, carrying the stick. But, yes, this is one of my absolute favorite. It was the last film Mikhail Soave did for almost 10 years.
Really?
When he did come back, he did a crime drama with Anna Falchi again.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, any of Suave's films, because he did a couple of really good, a slasher film called Stage Fright, which is really good. The third Demons film, which is called The Church. And The Sect. All of these are really great, very surreal horror films. But the interesting thing about The Sect is it features Jamie Lee Curtis's sister.
Didn't even know she had a sister.
I didn't know she had a sister either, but that's her sister. That's it. You got your six, so let's just go over our list again.
Very quickly to recap, 1959's House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price. The original, and in my opinion, a slightly better one than the remake, although I do recommend that you see the remake. From Dusk Till Dawn 3, The Hangman's Daughter. The Robert Rodriguez, Quentin Tarantino produced third part in the Dusk Till Dawn series, and I believe that was it.
They've never done anymore.
Right. If you like westerns, if you like vampires, you like horror, you like action, you like adventure, get this one. This is like if Sam Peckinpah had did a vampire movie, and the third one is Don Coscarelli's Phantasm from 1979. The science fiction horror hybrid with that wonderful performance by Angus Scrimm as the tall man.
Correct me if I'm wrong. He doesn't say a word in that film.
Angus Scrimm was the one that said "boy" before any rapper because that's what he says in the movie.
Yes.
He's got that kind of "boy." Definitely Phantasm and the tall man. To me, he's just as iconic a recent horror figure as Michael Myers or Freddy Krueger. If they were going to remake any horror movie, I would really love to see this one remake with modern day special effects.
And my three choices for Halloween viewing pleasure: the Hammer film Captain Cronus Vampire Hunter, the David Tui directed science fiction hybrid Pitch Black, and please don't bother with the sequel. Sequel, no good. And the absolutely gonzo zombie comedy slash horror movie slash
psychological,
who knows what the fuck it is.
Psychological drama, whatever.
Cemetery Man. These are all available on DVD, so you can get them from your local Hollywood or Blockbuster
Netflix. Whatever you like to do.
Is it time to do the wrap-up? Tell people how to reach us?
Yes, Tom. Please do the wrap-up.
If you have any suggestions for films that you'd like to curl up with on Halloween that you would like to let us know about, you can give us an email at betterinthedark, that's better, the letter N, thedark, at gmail.com. You can join our Yahoo mailing list, especially if you want to participate in our logo contest.
Booyah!
At movies.yahoo.com/groups/betterinthedark. You should always, of course, vote for us at Podcast Alley every month because that's how we get the rankings get higher.
We came from way behind.
Yeah,
we should mention, thank you. Yeah,
we started in like the thousands. We are now in the 200 range. And on Podomatic, which is another thing, if you download us directly from Podomatic, which is at betterinthedark.podomatic.com, we have gone from way down in the hundreds to we're now 28.
To 28.
People must be liking us. While you're at Podcast Alley, like I always say, check out some of our friends. One of our frequent Yahoo mailing list posters has a really cool podcast called Bend the Media. Parker.
Yeah, that's Parker. Bend the Media.
So check that out. That's really cool.
Very cool 15-minute.
Exactly.
Yeah, very cool. You know, if you don't have a lot of time, he's great to listen to.
I also want to drop another one that's like really short, but if you like genre movies, is really cool. It's called Poptopia.
Okay.
Much like Parker's, it's exactly 15 minutes. Love those like little ones that are just like almost like pieces of popcorn that you can just snatch up and listen to.
Listen to it real quick if you don't
and
have
Parker's
a lot.
Doing some good work, so
go check him out.
Bend the Media. And yeah, check out them. We've talked about Podcrawlers before. We've talked about people like Cool Shot on the Tube.
Yeah.
All these people, check them out. They're totally cool.
We like them and you like them too.
Right.
So
that's it. We're going to be taking a little break from all the blood and the gore in November because we're going to be doing the sports movies.
November? I thought we were going to do Doctor Who.
That's a special December thing.
Oh, I let it out of the bag.
That's right. For December, we've decided we're going to do three episodes for December. To tie in with the third Doctor Who Christmas special, we're going to do a two-part episode on Doctor Who, both past and present. And, of course, we'll be doing a special Christmas suggestions episode as well. Next one that you're going to hear after this is probably going to be our sports
one. It's going
to
be the sports one, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to take a little break from all the gore and the grue and the guts. Till then, this has been Tom DJ.
And this has been Derek Ferguson.
And whatever you do, no matter where you go, all we ask you to do is go see that movie. Good night.
Take care.
You've been listening to Better in the Dark, featuring Thomas E.J. and Derek Ferguson. Special thanks go out to Parker at Bend the Media and the members of the Better in the Dark Yahoo group at movies.groups.yahoo.com/group/Better in the Dark. Better in the Dark assures its listeners that not all south of the border strip clubs in the middle of nowhere are vampire nests. But, you know, it pays to play it safe. Previous episodes for the show can be downloaded from betterinthedark.podomatic.com. Send all comments, praise, hate mail, and pipe bombs to betterinthedark@gmail.com. That's better, the letter N, thedark@gmail.com. Please vote for us on Podcast Alley. Better in the Dark is a Conspiracy Productions presentation. All material copyright Thomas DJ and Derek Ferguson. Until next time, remember that if a vampire trods upon the grave of a toad, life to the toad the... Oh, look it up already.
Hey, you had a dream. Just a nightmare.